Hey, this is John F. Mers, author, actor, and owner of 1021 Studios, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout.
Hey everyone, how's it going? Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Max Bowen.
And I'm Curtis Hughes. Max, how's it going, pal?
Curtis, it's going pretty good, man. It's going pretty good. You know, our next guest has a really wonderful story to share, but here's the thing. It's pretty much reality. Our next guest is known for titles such as X-Force, Darth Vader, Suicide Squad, and Invader Zim. Yes, that Invader Zim, guys. Remember him? I sure as hell do. So certainly, I'm going to love this conversation, but we're not here to talk about any of that. Instead, we're talking about his true life story, which you can only get through Comixology exclusive. Dennis Hopeless joins us to talk about his series. She's Running on Fumes. Dennis, welcome to the show, man. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So Dennis, let's start off the bat. How much of this is real versus how much of this is fiction?
When I was pitching it, I called it a 60% true story. It is based on real events. A lot of the things in there that seem the most fictional are the most real. But the crime elements of the book were like exaggerated and changed because the characters that are my family members are all 100% real. That's how it worked. All of the other characters in the book are amalgams of real life people or, you know, loosely based on real life people, because obviously I couldn't get other people's permission. And then the actual crime elements, once I was building the plot, you know, we ramped it up and gave it a Hollywood treatment. So it's probably a little less, if we're being honest, than 60% real, but all of the stuff with my father's wreck and my parents' relationship and all the weird stuff that happened when we were down in the country, that's all real.
And so we were talking a bit before we started recording about, you know, how the story is very personal to you. You know, why did you want to share this story?
The story is built out of these well-worn family stories that I've known since I was little. And my parents would tell, you know, when you're talking to small children, you obviously don't tell every detail of everything, but you tell these stories around them and they get to know them. And what I started to realize, especially after my dad passed when I was in my 20s, is that there were darker and more criminal elements that were being added, details that were being added to these stories over time. And it wasn't until after I was already, I think, writing my early comic books that I realized, like, oh, my father was a criminal when I was little. Like, these stories are about a criminal doing criminal things, and just all the edges have been shaved off. So it was like this fascinating family secret. It wasn't even really a secret. I just wasn't given all the dirt until I was older. It's something I always wanted to mine. It was a weird part of my childhood and of my, like, my understanding of my mother and of my parents that I wanted to play with, but I never knew how to do it as a comic book. Like, I never knew how to put it into genre fiction. Like, what do you give, put aliens and robots in the story? Like, how are we going to do this? And what I found at Marvel, a lot of times I would accidentally put autobiographical stuff in my stories. Like, whatever I was going through in my real life or whatever existential problem I was tackling would end up in Spider-Woman or would end up in X-Men or whatever. And so the idea of just straight up doing that was always really appealing. And almost 10 years ago now, I remember waking up and I had been thinking about this time period in the story and like, what could I do for my next creator own pitch? And I got the idea from an actual like car theft and chop that my dad had done with a buddy of his that was part of one of these stories. Well, what if it was like the chop shop was a plot point and I did it as a crime story. So what if I take that element and expand it into a crime plot and then have these real things that happened with my parents when my dad was in his wreck and my mom had to like step up and learn how to take care of the family. What if she did it in a weed sort of way? Like, what if she had to go follow his criminal path in order to pay off these mounting hospital bills that were really very real? And then how do I turn the heat up on that and make a compelling crime story out of it? So it was about a decade ago that I like really decided that was what I was going to do. And then it was just a matter of finding time for it and finding the right creative team and the world shutting down from a global pandemic that turned off all of my Marvel work. So I had time to dig in and figure out how to do it.
Okay. You know, you mentioned incorporating some of your real life goings on in some of your other titles. Could you give a couple examples of this? Because like, given what you've worked on, I'm curious how these kind of express themselves.
Yeah, I don't always notice it at the time. Some of them are obvious. So like when Secret Wars happened, when I was at Marvel, I was writing Spider-Woman, and we had taken Jessica Drew and made her quit the Avengers and stop doing all of the crazy big superhero nonsense and go back to being a private eye. Well, the reason I did that is because the experience of writing a side story and launching a book during Spider-Verse was such a headache and so difficult for me personally that I was saying, to hell with all of this. We're just going to tell little street level spider stories with her, and that'll be fun. So that, like, that was a little bit autobiographical. But then, you know, we were getting momentum and telling that story, and fans were starting to get into it, and we all had to stop our books and jump 8 months ahead after the Secret Wars event, because they had smashed the Ultimate Universe together with the regular universe and whatever. And at the time, I had 4-month-old twin boys at home and my first kids, and I was really trying to deal with the existential crisis of becoming a parent, and how do you do work on a deadline when you only get 2 hours of sleep and you have to be up all night with the kids and you now have this priority that's not you. And, you know, I'm telling a story about this woman that has never had a normal life, who tries to do normal and is bad at it. So let's hit her in the face with normal. Like, the hardest version of normal is like that period of time right after kids are born, when they're exhausting and you think you're going to kill them and you don't know what to do. So that's the most obvious one that I did. But like, there's weird, like, my divorce worked its way into my Cloak and Dagger story, all sorts of weird little stuff. I actually wrote a story during another book that I did during the pandemic, was Hard Eyes with Victor Ibanez. And I had an interviewer ask me, because they'd heard me say this before, is this story about what it was like trying to start a new relationship after a divorce and feeling like, well, this thing failed. Are you just going to kill this like you killed that? And it absolutely probably was, because I wrote it in the middle of my now current relationship at the end of the tumult that was the post-divorce period. But I never thought of that. Like, I didn't realize I had done that. That wasn't the point. What I was writing about was like the terror of the pandemic and the Lovecraftian post-apocalyptic situation, because we were all trapped at home. But those ideas had worked their way into the story and I didn't realize it. So it's all over the place. There's little things in everything.
Wow. You know, I've actually been reading Spider-Woman, and I sort of jumped in during the time when she, you know, has her son Jerry and starts what she tries to do, like a normal life, basically. So interesting, because I always really liked that, because I always felt like this is real. This is like her dealing with the stress of being like a parent, a single parent at times, trying to keep her kid out of her life, and that does not work out at all, as you'll see in the more recent issues, because that doesn't work at all. Interesting. So definitely this is not the first time your real life has sort of factored into what you do as a comic writer, although this is more intentional, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of the opposite. I had to figure out how to comicize a real life story as opposed to the opposite.
Yeah.
But the thing that they have in common, I've always wanted to put the human condition into everything I write. Like, I've always sort of felt like I got off at the wrong floor at the writer building and I was being forced to write all these superheroes punching each other, when what I really wanted to do was human drama. And so I wanted everything, like, even if it was two superheroes or two superpowered beings fighting each other, I wanted their motivations to be real and human, and what they were going through and their damage all makes sense. And so I think, you know, my personal experience and the experience of my loved ones is the easiest way to find that. And so I think that's probably why it would get pulled in, like, oh, I can relate to this situation. Let me put that in. But yeah, with this, it was my pitch for this book, for She's Running on Fumes, was a whole long page description of everything that happened before the story starts, like my original pitch. And I sent it out to some writer friends and they were like, this is all cool, but the story is what happens after. Like, what happens after this? I'm like, well, I don't know. That part's not real. Like, I didn't figure that out. So it was, yeah, building a crime story and then finding those real life nuggets, like the snakes in the toilet and different things, the flies in the waiting room of the hospital that actually happened, that I got from interviews with my mom. And baking those into the crime plot.
Let's talk about the humans, though, in this story. So this thing is set in Deepwater, Missouri, circa 1984. Jody, your dad, is severely injured in a car wreck. His wife, your mom, discovers that he was trafficking drugs and cocaine, actually, and has to basically begin her own criminal career running a chop shop just to keep everything afloat and pay back the money that she owes. And man, the characters in this thing were very, very gritty. And I'm kind of curious how you were able to collect all the details so you could kind of fill in the gaps, because you were very, very young when all this happened.
Yeah, it was interesting that the first draft of this, of the first issue, was mostly based on my recollection of the stories as they were told to me. And then whenever I went back to my mom and I started doing recording these interviews, actually, as I was doing them, because it was really interesting to dig in. And, you know, my mom hasn't thought about this stuff in 30 years. So getting those details as she remembers them, you know, the reality is probably somewhere in between how I was originally told and how she remembers it now. But it was fun to find those little nuggets and to get a new perspective on the specific details of things. Like there's a beat in the book where she makes a game out of killing the flies in the waiting room of the hospital, because it was the waiting room was under construction, so it was open to the outside and had like a plastic sheeting, so there were flies in there and they were stuck in the waiting room for weeks. So they were, you know, they made a game out of it. So I put that in the book. And yeah, it was really odd and interesting experience to talk to her about that and see her like digging those things up. Cause my mom, after this period of time, went on and put herself through college and entered corporate America. And my mom's a very respectable woman in her 60s now, who, you know, this isn't part of her life anymore. It's like a weird, dark period from when she was very young. She was in her early to mid 20s when this was going on. And seeing her like relive that and bring those emotions up was emotional for me and interesting and sort of scary, and made the weight of writing this thing and getting it right and making it good bigger and heavier. But she was really open and honest with me. And I think, you know, the fact that my dad is gone and has been gone for 20 years, and my sister was on board, she was okay with it. Almost everybody else in the book has passed or is a fictional character that's an amalgam of other people. So I didn't really have to worry about stepping on any toes, which was nice. And yeah, my mom was on board, so that helped.
I'm curious how your mom reacted when you told her, hey, so I'm going to make a comic about, you know, you, me, and dad.
Yeah, initially, she was always really supportive. My mother's always been very supportive of my creative endeavors. My mom's a photographer who works in corporate IT. So she was always really happy that I went into a creative field and was able to do this stuff. She's always been really supportive. And that was how she approached this. She was into it. She was happy to help, happy to be a part of it. But I didn't realize how heavy that was going to be until I started writing it. Like, you know, you're writing a tense scene between your parents where they're fighting or kissing, or my dad's having an episode because of his brain damage and destroying stuff. And you realize like, oh, this is really emotionally intense for me. What's it going to be like for her? So I was very curious after the process of writing it and after going through that, like, emotional experience, what it was going to be like for her to read it or for it to exist or to see like a fictionalized version of some of the worst, hardest times of her life. But I asked her about it. Like I did these interviews and I recorded it. And after she had read the first couple of issues, I asked her how she felt about it. And we had a local con here that I posted some of those videos that as like promotional material to promote that I was going to be there. And I did a print edition of the first issue of the book, just exclusive for that show. And I asked her, and she's like, if she was concerned about the judgment or about what people were going to think of her. And she said she'd not really thought about it. So like, she doesn't really love having her like video on of herself, that she doesn't like being on video, but she didn't mind that as much. I think she said she was honored that I thought her life story was interesting enough to make a story out of it, which was great.
That's really cool. I like that. Yeah. I like that. All right. So we've talked a bit about how this is not like 100% a retelling. It's like partial. What portions are fictionalized, and why did you have to go that route for completing the story?
I made the crime portion of the story more intense and more immediate. Like, the reality of the situation is my parents crawling out of this hole was a longer process. Like, what happened to their relationship because of these events took years to sort of fall apart, build up, fall apart, crumble. And so I wanted all of that to happen like on the page. So there were a lot of things from later conversations, feelings, that I forced them to have earlier and faster. So like the timeline of my dad's car accident and brain damage and the fallout from that, all of that's pretty straightforward how it worked. I mean, you know, things are moved around a little bit because it's a comic book, but the crime elements, it was like, what if the crime stuff my dad was legitimately doing with the people he was doing with at the time blew up in the worst possible way at the worst possible moment? So that part of the story is fiction. So all of the crime that you watch in the book that's specifically shown, all of that is fiction, but it's based on real stuff that was happening. And it's like a what if the worst case scenario had happened during the wreck, if that makes sense.
Perfect sense, yeah. And so question is, at what age were you, if you could recall, you know, when you started to kind of piece things or realize that things weren't as up and up, as they say, as they would seem to be? When did you kind of start making the kind of connections that, this is not your typical family?
I didn't really put together that dad was straight up a criminal before the wreck, because he wasn't after that. Like in reality, after that, after the having to learn how to walk again and dealing with the brain damage and going to rehab, my dad went to technical school and got a straight job. And for the most part, as far as I know, was a, you know, like a functional member of society after that. But I think in my early 20s is when I started to realize, like, okay, some of these stories have new elements that make it clear that, like, we moved down to this terrible trailer in the country that was on my grandfather's land because my dad had been embezzling money from the place that he worked at. And he got freaked out that they got wise and had moved down. Cause at the time in 1984, you could just move 2 hours away and then they lost you. If you had a blue collar job. So like elements like that, I started to figure out, I think when I was in college. But there's always been this sense, especially because I worked in superhero comics, I always felt like this notion of black and white, right and wrong, like superheroics as a reasonable idea. It never really made sense with how I was raised. Like I was always raised in the gray area where, like, as long as nobody gets hurt, it's okay if we pay a little less for this, or it's okay if we, you know, buy the clothes before the Midnight Madness sale and take them back with the wrong receipt because then you can get the right sizes and it's easier. Like those sorts of things. Which is not like a massive moral gray area, but like that's how I was raised. I was raised to work the system. I was raised to find loopholes and figure out how to get around. And we were also very poor when I was very young. So some of this was just getting by. But yeah, this idea that there are like these beacons of integrity and ethics out there that are doing everything right, like it didn't parse with me. And it's because I was raised by people that had gone through these things and had done these criminal acts, and it didn't really see anything wrong with it necessarily. And like I said, my mom doesn't feel that way now, but I was raised in a moral gray area. And I think I always knew that. I saw that and I related more to other people that saw it that way. And I think that helped me in my superhero career. People always loved my supervillains because they were never mustache twirlers. You could always get where they were coming from. You know, I said at one point in my Jean Grey run, I have Emma Frost tell Jean Grey, "Your nightmare is my love story. Like, I know how you see this, but nobody cares how I see it." Which, because that's the only way Emma's behavior makes sense, is if she was actually in love during that Morrison run. So it has given me a perspective now that I can like try to find what makes sense about that and what's good about that and put it in my writing, but definitely raise my kids a little bit more in the good and evil and like be compassionate and kind to each other and these things that I didn't necessarily get.
Yeah, understandable. How long did it take from the initial idea of wanting to do, you know, the writing for the comic to the actual finished product?
So I started writing it into 2020 because it was during the lockdown. And I think that moment where I sat up in bed and figured out how to do it was 2016, 2017. So it took 3 or 4 years to get there, but it mostly was because when I was in the heat of my Marvel career, they kept me very, very busy, very fed, and I'm not prolific. I'm a slow and considered writer is the nice way to put it. So I was never able to really dig into creator own books the way that I wanted to. And when everything stopped in 2020, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go insane just sitting here staring at my five-year-olds. So I need to write something. So I reached out to collaborators and came up with a book. With this one, I always knew it had to have a different look. And like most of my art friends and people that I worked with before lean more in the superhero direction. And I wanted to have this to have a more of an indie feel to it. But when I was at Boom, when I was working on the WWE book at Boom, I met Tyler Jenkins and we hit it off. And I knew that he liked this sort of thing, like through Grass Kings. Grass Kings kind of was developed out of an idea of his. And it felt very much like the world that I grew up in. It had that like sun baked, everything's rusting and splitting sort of look to it. And so I thought that that was perfect. But I also thought there's no way Tyler's ever going to work on this. Like he's super busy. He's out doing other things. So when I wrote the pitch, I sent it to Tyler just as a buddy, like, hey, what do you think of this? This is up your alley. And his response when he called me back about it was, did you send me this to see what I think of it? Or because I'm the perfect artist to draw it? So Tyler like jumped on board without me even having to ask, which was cool. And that was the point at which it really started going. Like I'd been tinkering with it for years and I felt like I had the pitch ready. And then once Tyler was on board, then I just started sending it out. And Comixology, Chip Mosier, who's not at Comixology anymore, but he was the person I pitched it to. Like he was all about it. The moment he saw the pitch, he wrote me back 10 minutes later and was like, yes, let's absolutely do this. And they were able to give us a budget. So the creative team got like real rates and could do it for real, fit it into their schedules, which is awesome. And then because Tyler's so busy and had other projects to do, it took a while to finish. Cause yeah, we did, I think he started drawing it in earnest in mid 2020. And Comixology doesn't release until the entire book is done and all the pre-press is done. So it's completely ready to go. So it took about, I don't know, 3.5 years, probably, soup to nuts, to get it done.
Enjoying the podcast? Get even more of the content you love from artists around the world on Citywide Bites. Experience the show live on Saturdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, only on Instagram. With our interactive short-form interview series, you can ask your questions and be a part of the action. Hosted by Max Bowen.
Wow. Very cool. Now, we are in issue 3 currently, as of the time of this recording. And the story is definitely kicking into high gear, but can we get any hints, without, of course, spoiling it, can we get any hints as to what kind of lies in store for everyone?
Yeah, everything gets worse for everyone relatively rapidly from where you are.
Oh, geez.
We don't really let up. And I wanted to do the crime version of how that really felt for my mom. And at this time, my mom was working at the grocery store and bringing home like dented cans that were going to be thrown away to eat herself because she could only afford to bring food for us. So she had enough food to feed us and to pay enough of the hospital bills to keep Dad in the hospital. And she was eating dented canned food. And these hospital bills were so huge relative to the amount of income that was coming in and no idea if Dad was ever going to recover, that it was crushing. So I wanted to do the crime version of that. So definitely we just keep turning the heat up until everybody's charred. But I feel like everything twists and turns in a way that you're not going to expect. Like whatever you expect from issue 3 to be where I'm headed, it's definitely not where I'm headed. And I didn't want it to be a stereotypical crime story, like because I got to make that part up. I wanted it to fit in with the weirdness of everything else that was happening. Also, one really cool thing that I did not know, you asked earlier, at what age I figured out all the different elements of this. There's one element of the story that I figured out at whatever I am, 42, which is that my father's personality and a lot of the like mood swings and anger and just big emotions that I dealt with my father is a very common long-term effect of traumatic brain injury. And nobody told us that. I had no idea. And I don't remember my dad from before that. So I let Robbie Thompson's a buddy of mine. He's a fantastic comic writer and screenwriter. And I had him read the book, and his mom was a trauma nurse. And so he knew all of this stuff and had that context. And he gave it to me and said, this is really common. Like your dad, that wasn't necessarily your dad. That might've been his brain injury. So I was able to take that and put it in the book. And I think that's how I put it in the book in the caption, because I'm the narrator of the book. Like me now is telling the story. And so I was able to be like, here's a thing I didn't know. Like it's possible that this stuff that I remember is just my dad was actually brain damage. So that was a fascinating thing, you know, years after his passing, to find out and to like come to terms with.
How do you view your dad, knowing what you know now, especially after talking to your mom and getting more details about who he was as a person?
So the one big takeaway, other than the one I just said, from writing this book was my parents were very, very young when all this was happening. And it was a very tense situation. My dad came from trauma. You know, he grew up in trauma. And I really do think they were just doing their best. There's a moment later on in the book where I say I never understood how my mom ended up with this man, because the mother that raised me wouldn't have put up with his shit from the beginning. Like, she just wouldn't have dealt with this. But she was 17. She was a child when she met him. And the woman that I remember went through all of this, was forged in the fire of this, and is a much stronger person because she had to be to survive it. And so I think now, especially having written the book, that colors my perspective on my dad. Like, I don't think my dad was a monster. There was a period of time, probably when I was a teenager after my parents divorced and before he died, that I did kind of think of him as the villain of my story, but I no longer see it that now that I have kids and understand how difficult it is to do the right things, even knowing the right things, and even being in a situation where I don't have all the stress of the world on my shoulders, it's still hard to be a great parent all the time. It's easier now to let that go. But also, when I was 20 and he died, I was asked at the last minute to write and give a eulogy. They were like, you're a writer, give his eulogy. And so the night before my father's funeral, I had to come to terms with all of my angry black feelings about this person, because the first draft of that would be something you wouldn't want to get up and say at a funeral. And I think in that moment, I gave him some grace and found the things that were positive about their relationship. And what I love comic books because my dad stole a box of comics out of some barn he was going through when I was a little kid and gave me these 70s books. Again, a story that I didn't realize was criminal until after the fact. And I love genre fiction because we watched Tales from the Crypt together and we watched Star Trek The Next Generation together. And a lot of what became my passion and my love and my career came from him, even though we had a tumultuous relationship. And he, as tough as it was being raised by him, he was there. You know, he never left. He never gave up. He always stuck around and he was always there. And yeah, so I think this was like step one of the process of forgiving my dad and then seeing him in a more positive light was his death and the eulogy I had to write. And I think step two was the writing of this book. I very much don't want him to be seen as the villain of the story. He's a force of nature in the story, and he's a problem for my mom in the story, but he's just a person. He's a person that went through an awful thing and is just doing what he does within that. And she's having to figure out how to set boundaries and navigate that once she realizes, oh, I can survive without this person having the reins. I have a complicated relationship with how I feel about my father, but I definitely don't think he's a bad guy.
All right, let's talk a little background, because we always like to ask folks kind of how they got into their lines of work. Now, I know that prior to working in comics as a writer, you worked in actual like comic store, which dream job for me growing up, which I never had to actually do. Did you know at that point that you wanted like this to be your job, that you wanted to work in comics?
I wanted to be a screenwriter. So I'm from Kansas City, Missouri, and I went to school in the middle of nowhere in Kansas, K-State. And when I graduated, I moved back to Kansas City because my ex-wife had graduated earlier and was working here. And so in whenever that was, 2004, there weren't a lot of screenwriting opportunities in flyover states. So I was sort of just writing stuff in my notebook while working at this terrible Best Buy job that I got after college. And a comic book store opened up in my hometown. And I had the same thing. I'd always wanted to work at a comic shop. I was working retail anyway and hated it. And I thought, I'm going to go all in on getting this comic shop job. So I go in, I talk to the guy, and he's like, I don't really need employees now. I'm going to hire at some point, but you know, we're a comics and game store, so I want to hire someone that knows the gaming side. And I play Dungeons and Dragons with my kids now, but I had not done any tabletop gaming. I knew nothing about Magic the Gathering. Like, games were not my life. And I was like, oh, okay. So where would one go online to learn these things? So I went and did like 3 days of research into like collectible card games and all this different stuff in order to get this job and impress the guy. That's the hardest anyone's ever worked for $6 an hour. But I went and got this job at the comic shop. And because he couldn't pay us very much, he gave us a ton of store credit. So for the 2 or 3 years that I worked there, I was getting 70 books a month. Like I read all of DC's output, all of Marvel's output. And this was like around the Secret Identity era. And like when the big tentpole events had started to kick back up in the early 2000s, and Image, like Walking Dead was brand new, and all of these Image things were blowing up, Invincible, different things. So I think it gave me a great education in comics beyond what, you know, as a college kid getting 3 or 4 titles a month that I understood about the industry, pulling stuff out of the boxes, seeing what jumped off the shelf, seeing like what the right cover, the right logo grabs people, and what like a great comic shop employee who can ask you what you're into and take you to the book that would appeal to you, like how important that is, which was, I think, big for me in figuring out how to come up with a hook and how to pitch a thing and how to talk to retailers when I've got a creator-owned book coming out. But that, yeah, that experience sort of invigorated my love for comics, which I already had. And then also I was in the middle of nowhere. So when a comic artist who had gone to Kubert School came in, wanted to talk about that, I was like, oh, we could make movies on paper and I could sell them here. So I think that is kind of how I got there. I met Kevin Mellon, who drew my first and second book and is still one of my best friends today, just because he came into the comic shop. He lived in town and came in and knew the owner from when he had worked at another comic shop when he was a kid. And that's how we hit it off. So very much that was the incubator of my comics career. Yes.
Okay. All right. I have to know, what was the first comic you read and the first comic you worked on?
I think the first two comics I ever read, it was a 2-pack that I got from a Stuckey's on a road trip when I was 6 or 7. And it was a Planet Terry Star Comics, like adaptation of a cartoon no one remembers. And then some random issue of Firestorm that the only thing I remember about it is it had a person that had thorns going through their body on the cover, like this very uncomfortable looking man who had thorns sticking out of his body on the cover. Those are the first two. And then I remember getting back issues of Justice League International from that box of comics that my dad had stolen. That was the first thing that I was really into. It was the like Giffen, Dematis, Justice League. So those were kind of the earliest stuff when I could read and actually understand what was going on. And then the first comic I wrote, like worked on, I did a book called Gearhead at Arcana in 2007 with Kevin Mellon. It's about a girl in a post-apocalyptic wasteland who drives a cool hot rod and beats people with a wrench.
That is a great elevator pitch. I love that one. Drives a hot rod, beats folks with a wrench.
At this point, I've been selling at a con for like 20 years, so I got it down.
And are you self-taught with the writing, formal education classroom? What age were you when you started?
I went to college. I double majored in creative writing and video production. So like both my filmmaking background from a little bit of writing you do on the video production side at Kansas City University, and then my creative writing classes, you could say I have a degree in it. I didn't learn a lot about writing in college. I learned a lot about reading and I learned a lot about analysis. And I think it forced me to actually finish things, which was important. But my real education came once I met Kevin and I had someone who could draw the book who was waiting on me to turn things in. So we did a couple of short stories and then eventually that led to Gearhead. And I think having someone waiting on me and understanding that he could get bored and this opportunity could go away is what drove me to get things done, which was always a problem before. And then when the first issue of Gearhead was drawn and I wrote it, he drew it, I flatted it so we could get it colored. And then he taught me how to letter and I lettered it because he was drawing issue 2. And then I read it. And you know, whenever you're reading comics and you've never written one and you think of yourself as a good writer, you're like, I can do better than this. And that was when I really learned like, oh, I can't. Like the things that I'm good at that other people are weak at, you don't get to take their weak comic and put your good stuff on top of it. You have to understand all of the stuff that they're doing that you have no concept of. So I really learned in that moment, like, oh, I got to catch up. Like in order to even have anyone ever think I'm any good, I'm going to have to learn a bunch of things that aren't what I care about. Like I always cared about dialogue and character drama, but I had no idea how to plot something and make it compelling. I didn't understand how to structure a first issue so that it ended in a place where you cared what was going on. I didn't know how to introduce the interesting elements of the story and also build the world at the same time so it didn't feel like you were just getting info dump. I didn't know how to do any of that. And I'd never noticed that anybody was doing it until that moment. So I think my education came making stuff that you have good enough taste to tell that it's not good yet is the thing that's like, oh, wow, I got a lot to learn.
Well, folks, we are coming down to the end of the conversation. But Dennis, a few more questions before we go. Now, you've worked on a lot of titles, some really like big name companies, big name titles. Where do you think She's Running on Fumes sits amidst all this?
It's my favorite thing I've ever done, which is an unfair fight because it's the most recent thing I've done. And it's also so personal. I also think it's the culmination of the kinds of stories I was trying to tell on Spider-Woman and on some of my other creator-owned work and Marvel work. I think I had to do all of that stuff to get to here. So it's my favorite. The thing it's the most similar to is probably Spider-Woman. I think Jessica Drew, my version of Jessica Drew, owes a lot to my mom, especially like going through the parenting and like being able to say how hard this is while also making it clear that it's the most important thing in your life and that you love your kids. Like, that was very much the person that raised me. So I think fans of that would like She's Running on Fumes. But yeah, it's, you know, I loved my Marvel career and it was a really fun job, but it's a treadmill and you are trying to do the best version of the thing they've asked you to pitch within the confines of what fits with what's currently going on and what you're allowed to do. And like I said, I'm not very fast. So it was me doing it at a clip that was always a little bit uncomfortable. And I always wished I had more time and had another draft. She's Running is a book that I was able to take my time on. I was able to figure it out, get the whole thing plotted, work with an editor on the beginning, middle, and end before I wrote the first issue, write the first issue, rework it, work with the artist. Like, I was able to do it at an actual comfortable pace. And I think it shows. I think the book has moments to have time to breathe. It feels like a complete world. Like, it is, I'm really proud of how that worked. And it's actually changed my life in that I don't want to go back. Like, at this point, I just want to do projects that I'm passionate about and that I own and that I can really put my whole back into promoting, not having to worry about keeping my lights on. So it is the first of the next stage of my writing career for sure.
I feel like we're ending this with the most important part here, that you're saying for now it's only projects like She's Running. So I just want to dig into this for a little bit, but does this mean
sure.
No more X-Force, no more Spider-Woman?
I would not turn down a job that I really wanted to do. Sure. Like, I did a Plastic Man short story with Baldemar Rivas, who's a buddy of mine that lives in town, last time it came out, Valentine's Day. And I did that because I wanted to work with Baldemar. Like, we've always wanted to work together and we got an opportunity to do this thing and it was super fun. I didn't do it for the money. I did it because I wanted to work with him and Plastic Man's cool, right? So that was fun. So I'm not saying I wouldn't do it, but there's something about the chase and about having to continue to write these stories at a clip forever in order to make a living, especially, you know, when you've got kids and bills and all of the stressors of life. And I just got worn out and I didn't know how worn out I was. You know, if Pencils Down had never happened and I hadn't taken 6 months where my focus was my kids, I wouldn't have realized, like, I'm kind of tired of writing 3 superhero stories a month, every month, and having to fit to wedge the things that I want to say about life into the 8 pages that aren't punching of every issue. And, you know, getting a breather from that. Now, figuring out how I was going to make a living with nothing on my resume except for Marvel was really stressful and hard. But now that I'm in a place where, you know, like, I can have a career and then I can have my writing and they aren't necessarily the same thing. And I don't have to count on a very tumultuous industry to keep my lights on. It's great. It's super creatively freeing. It allows me to, like, feel like an adult and not have to ride the wave of all this stuff all the time. So I would say yes to the right superhero project. I still love superheroes and I've taken a break. So, you know, like, those juices are still there and flowing, but yeah, if I'm going to put my energy into something that may or may not ever make me any money or be a massive success or whatever, I want it to be something like a story that I want to tell. I want it to be something that I'm proud to give to people and that I spent time on. And that I'm, you know, when my kids are old enough, they can read it and be proud of it too.
So then this last question takes on a whole new meaning, I think. What is next for you?
The next thing I'm doing is another creator-owned project that Chris Grind and I, as another buddy here in town, have been talking about for 13 years. We pitched it multiple places, and we almost got it through. And we decided we're going to kickstart it. And marketing is the job that I have now. The thing that I do for my day job now is marketing. And so we're going to use all of the stuff that I've learned the last few years getting into marketing to promote this thing for real and do a Kickstarter and do some viral stuff. So I can't talk about it yet because of how I plan on marketing the thing, but it's very different. Chris is currently doing the Animorphs adaptations for Scholastic. So it's a very like middle grade style, and that fits perfectly with what we're going to do. So yeah, that's going to be a big part of my next year is building and promoting that.
Very cool, man. Very cool. Well, and I'm definitely looking forward to all the projects you have down the road. And folks, if you want to check out more of this great series, you go to Comixology. $6 a month, you get access to thousands upon thousands of titles. She's running on fumes now in issue 3 as of this recording. More issues to come. And you go to hopelesscomics.com for more information. And Dennis, thanks once again. An absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me.
And with that, we bring this episode to a close. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't already, check us out on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. You can catch this and all your favorite episodes on your favorite podcast platform. And new episodes are added every week, as well as on Boston Free Radio every Saturday at 10 p.m. You get at me at citywidemax@yahoo.com if you want to suggest a guest, submit your music, or just drop us a line. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.